Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 this November 14th, 2010. It's probably one of the great truisms in media over the past two decades that the internet's done nothing else. It's blasted open the corridors of intellectual power to the great bulk of the American people who have been boxed out or locked out through the bottleneck of the old commercial news media. It created the blogosphere and all sorts of other ways that ordinary Americans could participate as producers of content and change our political system. Today's guest will be discussing that concept and his research on that matter. Matthew Hine will be joining us to discuss the myth of digital democracy in his research. It's going to be an extraordinary show. Before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Mike McGinn, the mayor of Seattle, wants to slash the budget for the city's public access television station, Scan TV. Eight organizations have written to the city council, urging councilors to reject the proposal to cut the station's funding from $600,000 to $100,000. They warned that the drastic reduction would kill the nonprofit channel, and for communities which benefit directly from the local TV programming, the loss would be huge. Jonathan Lawson of Reclaim the Media is one of the signers.
Our local public access channel programs more locally produced public affairs a week than all of the broadcast TV stations combined.
And while that programming includes some offbeat and small niche programming, many shows provide an essential public service.
We're the only show in the city that is locally produced that's broadcasting in Somali or in Korean or in Vietnamese. So there are all these communities that are absolutely dependent upon that resource for community public affairs, for cultural information.
Many of the groups advocating for continuing support for SCAN have their own programming on the station.
A lot of immigrant-based community groups, non-English language speakers, the ACLU of Washington does a regular program on SCAN. Labor unions have offered programming on SCAN. The groups that came together with Reclaim the Media to issue this one particular letter to council represent groups that work with communities of color, groups that, like us, have a particular focus on how community media plays a role in community development and civic engagement in Seattle.
Other groups train young people in media arts and broadcasting.
You put a camera and a microphone in the hands of a young person, and they find out that the media can be a profoundly useful tool at finding your voice and using it.
Across the country, public media has been under attack for several years. Cable providers want to use the channels for commercial purposes. And with the economic slump, city governments are eyeing the cable franchise fees for other purposes.
Public access is oftentimes not considered the sexiest media democracy fight, but time has shown that what created public access and what is going to always protect public access is grassroots local activism.
Since the devastating earthquake last January, millions of dollars in donations and outside aid has flooded into Haiti to help with relief and recovery efforts. And several local groups in the country have been wondering how the money is actually being spent. They've launched a crowdsourced investigative reporting project to find out. Called Haiti Grassroots Watch, or Aitit Kaleje, meaning Haiti Eyes Peeled in Haitian Creole, is a watchdog partnership telling the untold stories of Haiti's reconstruction. American filmmaker Jane Regan, who has long reported on Haiti, moved to the country on a part-time basis to help with the project.
As we sat around talking, we realized, wow, there is going to be a massive influx of NGOs, humanitarian agencies, dollars, pounds, lira, francs, into this country. Who is going to keep an eye on it? And especially, who is going to keep an eye on all of that from the point of view of what's best for the Haitian people?
Regan is quick to point out that she's a spokesperson for the project simply because she speaks English, but the reporting is being done mostly by Haitians, from seasoned journalists to people just learning how to operate a camera. Regan says Haitians can no longer rely on the national mainstream media or U.S. journalists to deliver diverse and authentic reporting on the reconstruction efforts and its impacts on Haitians.
Visiting reporters are just that. They're visiting. They're only there for 3 days. They usually have to speak through an interpreter. So a lot of times they end up interviewing the same people who speak English. They have like a little mini Rolodex of the folks that they always talk to. And what we saw that was missing was getting voices from the grassroots, and not just from the Capitol, but from all over the country, to give their opinion and to also take a look at what was happening in and around their community.
Haiti Grassroots Watch released their second investigation this week, examining cash for work job programs that pay Haitians $5 a day to help with recovery work. While the program has been applauded internationally, the investigation finds that it contributes to the country's dependence on foreign food and leads to political corruption. The group is now trying to get the Haitian news media to pick up the story and to alert the American public to what is happening in the country beyond what is typically reported.
I hope that when publics read and listen and see those things, that it opens their eyes a little bit more to what Haitian people think about some of the stuff that's going on, and maybe it helps them see Haitians as more than just people dying of cholera or being swept away by floods.
To find out more information and watch their video investigations, visit HaitiGrassrootsWatch.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live, November 14th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today's guest is someone whose work became familiar to me a while back when I was in Washington, D.C. with my friend John Nichols, and we were fortunate enough to have breakfast with Michael Copps, the FCC commissioner for some time now, has been a guest on the program. And in passing, Michael Copps said, there's this book you guys have to read. It's the best thing I've ever read about the internet related to media. And he introduced me at that moment to the book, The Myth of Digital Democracy by Matthew Heinemann. Since then, I've had a chance to read the book, and I'm using it in my classes. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Matthew Heinemann to be our guest today on the program. Matthew Heinemann, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And you are, I've been looking at your bio, and I want to make sure I get this right. You are now presently, you've switched, you're teaching at George Washington, but you're on leave for a year at Harvard. Is that correct?
My permanent home is now at GW.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're working on a new book, just so I get the bio straight here, on the political economy of the public sphere online. Is that correct?
Yeah, the new book looks at trying to understand how content is produced on the web and what the economics of content production mean for who actually gets heard.
How far along is that research?
I'd say it's about half done.
And what's your ETA, do you think, on getting that published?
That will go out for review probably at the end of this year. Start at this time next fall.
Well, fantastic. Speaking selfishly, it will be a book I will be hanging on every word that you do write.
That's very kind.
Well, let's start with why Michael Copps was impressed by this book and why he brought it to my attention and John Nichols' attention, which was that in Washington and in academia, a dominant theme is that whatever one might think of the internet, is that the one thing everyone can agree is it has blasted open and made freedom of speech a viable construct now for all Americans, with the ability to go online to speak and not have to be have their words cleared by any sort of news media editor or any sort of corporate media bottleneck or whatever. And your book really, tries to, if not completely debunk that, at least qualify it dramatically and sort of carve it down to a much smaller size than the sort of mythology. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think one major theme of the book is that, in fact, there are gatekeepers online, and in some ways, quite powerful gatekeepers. They aren't necessarily exactly the same set of gatekeepers that we are familiar with from decades past, but they're still quite influential.
And let's just go right into the heart of the argument now so our listeners can understand it. Who are the gatekeepers and how do they affect content?
The most important gatekeeper gatekeepers are companies like Google, which help determine what people can actually see online. People don't necessarily think of Google as determining as shaping political discourse in a big way, but in fact, I think that that's exactly what they do. What people can actually find online is partly a result of how Google, what Google is able to show them.
And give an example of that, because you go through this in the book, and it's really some of the most interesting discussion in the book is your notion of Googlearchy, I think, as you call it, your theory of Googlearchy. Explain, because I think most people think, and I'll just put the words in, out there that I hear from my students, that, well, you know, how Google's this wonderful thing because, you can Google something. If you want to know about anything, you'll get a list from Google, and their experience shows that it's often usually a really good list. On the first page, you find what you're looking for. And, isn't this fantastic? Isn't this empowering us, therefore, to surf the web and make sense of it? And then, isn't this even enhancing the democratic potential of the web?
Oh, I think that there are, I don't think there's any question that Google has, has in some ways empowered the public. But this comes with a certain set of costs as well. Imagine, if you will, if every library in the country was run by one company that was doing the card catalog index. That's essentially what we have for democratic debate on the Internet, where so much of what people see is in the first three or four results in Google. Part of this is the fact that Google pays a lot of attention to link structure. That's certainly how they got started, and now increasingly they're paying attention to other aspects, other page characteristics as well. But in interaction with how people actually search, this ends up quite dramatically contracting the public sphere. Most people actually don't go out and do really complicated searches. They go out, if they're interested in abortion, for example, they'll type abortion into a web browser. And that means that most people who just have a passing interest in that topic are all routed to the same four or five different sites.
Now, you mentioned that Google is not the only search engine. There are two other major search engines, I guess, Yahoo and Microsoft Bing, that account for pretty much all of the market, in effect. But, you wrote this book, or did the research for the book, I should say, 3 or 4 years ago for the most part. And I think in the book you put Google at 60% of the search engine market. Has that increased since then?
It's slowly, steadily crept up. The number I saw this morning in the Wall Street Journal was that Google now is responsible for 83% of U.S. search volume, which is quite a lot. I think that puts Google firmly in monopoly category.
No, I think John D. Rockefeller would bend over to pick that one up.
that's much better than Standard Oil did at its height. Yes.
Yeah. So that's fairly. And in the book, you discuss. I think your discussion of Google goes into why that's taking place. Because again, let me go to sort of common explanations about the internet. The idea has been traditionally that this was going to be a place of innovation and competition, because the traditional barriers to entry would be much lower for everything economically, not simply for journalism or ideas or political ideas. And that, so if someone comes along with a better algorithm for search than Google, it doesn't take a fortune to come up with a brilliant algorithm. If a few smart people do it in their garage in Silicon Valley or wherever they're living, Bangalore or India for that matter, within a year or two, they can blow Google out because everyone would shift to the better product. Instead, though, rather than being sort of a basis of competition, as I read your book, it pretty much looks like Google's locked in forever. No one's kicking them out of anything, and that, as I read your book, Matthew Heinemann, I got the sense more the Internet's an engine of monopoly more than it is an engine of competition.
Well, we have to pay attention to what exactly which part of the process we're talking about. Now, in 1997, I think it was probably true that there were pretty low barriers to entry in the search engine market, for example. But I think that you saw very quickly is that that market solidified. So just in the past 5 years, for example, or between 2004 and 2009, Google spent, just based on its public records, its corporate disclosures, it spent more than $15 billion just on research and development and just on server farms. Now, to place that number in perspective, in inflation-adjusted terms, the Manhattan Project cost $20 billion in today's money. So this is an enormous investment. While it may have been the case that barriers to entry were low in 1998, I think it's pretty hard to make the same argument in 2010.
The costs, Matthew Heinemann, for Google are the research and development. They also have enormous physical capital expenses.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they also, what I found really interesting, most people might not be aware of, is that they pay major websites and to be the sole browser available on the website. Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. And in some ways, this is quite curious. I think it's very difficult to find any other market segment where you have a company with 83% market share that's paying billions of dollars every year so that potential customers will not use its only competitors.
Indeed it is. Now, one of the points you were making before, Matthew Hyman, was that that there is this dominance by Google. So basically what Google says is increasingly what people get. So if you Google abortion, as you put it, or Afghanistan war, or any particular political topic, people end up with the top three or four items on the Google page. And that's going to dominate then what's seen online. But what's interesting, too, is then you looked at Yahoo, which is still the number one competitor, I guess, but it's increasingly going from the status of Ford Motors to American Motors.
Yeah. So Yahoo no longer has its own search engine.
Okay.
So they made a deal.
So it truly is going the way of American Motors.
It's
gone the way of American Motors.
So what's really going on is that we have a monopolist in an adjacent market niche, in this case Microsoft, that's quite frightened of Google and wants to make sure that they don't get even more dominant. And so they're willing to burn billions of dollars a year in a money-losing product just to make sure that Google's hold isn't as secure as it might otherwise be.
And so basically it's down to Microsoft versus Google.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And Microsoft is sitting literally on billions of dollars right now in its bank account. Is just willing to burn some of that to sort of throw a monkey wrench in Google's plans?
Yeah, that's pretty much the pattern.
Matthew.
I think it's important not to demonize Google too much, though, because one thing I do talk about in the book is that part of what Google does in following links is that it ends up just reiterating and solidifying the sort of winners-take-all pattern that we see in the link structure of the web.
Yeah, explain how that works and why. Again, this the algorithm that Google uses is not any sort of conspiracy. It's worked very effectively for a reason, but it does have consequences. So why don't you explain, if you would, Matthew Hyman, what those are?
Well, the way that the Google algorithm worked when it was first put out was that it basically looked at sites that got a lot of links, and then it really decided that links could be a form of reputation. So sites that got a lot of links from other sites that got a lot of links were ranked very highly in the search engine. And that was a lot better than we were familiar with in the bad old days of search engines, something like AltaVista, which thought that the best page on cats would be the page that had cats listed, the word cats, 2,200 times on the page. But the way that this has worked in practice is that there's really only two ways to find a web page. Somebody you either follow a link that you've come across that somebody has sent you, or you go to a search engine. So naturally, the more paths there are to a site, the more links that there are, the more people who are going to find it and potentially like it and put even more links to it. So the result of this is that sites that have lots of links get more and more links, while sites that are sort of obscure usually remain obscure.
Our guest today, who we've been talking with, is Matthew Hyman. He's the author of the book, The Myth of Digital Democracy, published by Princeton University Press, available in paper. This book has won numerous awards, including Harvard's Goldsmith Book Prize, as well as the Donald McGannon Award for Communication Research. Dr. Hyman is a professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He's joining us live on the phone today. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment about the myth of digital democracy, our number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And the lines are open. Matthew Hyman, going back to this whole question of search engines, and I don't want to dwell too much on this, but it is such a central part of the argument and a way of understanding how the web is developing. But the point I was making is, even if there were a second search engine or multiple search engines, I mean, there's not a great deal of difference, is there, if you were to go to another major search engine, what's left of them, Bing or whatever, Yahoo, as to what you would locate on Google?
Initially, there was a big difference between Google and everybody else, but now that's exactly right. If you type, I think this is an exercise for the readers at home. Next time you're searching on the web, go ahead and type in the same query in Bing versus Google. Most of the time, what you find when you do that is the results are quite similar. And that, I think, actually speaks to the importance of branding. It speaks to the importance of having huge server farms and infrastructure. One of the things that Google finds is that just speeding up the results by 100 milliseconds, by a tenth of a second, actually makes a big difference in terms of how people perceive the results. Even if the ultimate, even if the results are actually are the same.
So just having the speed of the response on your computer be infinitesimally quicker is a big deal.
So when it first started out, Google had when you actually went to Google and typed in a Google search, you would hit four or five computers, and it would take a little more than a second. Now, when you go to Google and do a Google search, it's hitting thousands of computers, and the average search is returned in about 200 milliseconds.
Yep. And so to compete with that, just to finish this question of competition for a search engine, if someone were to come in to want to compete with Google so that people would use it, make the choice, I found something better than Google, the capital investment to compete with that, not to mention pay off people more money than Google pays them, is frankly impossible to conceive of.
Unless you're Microsoft.
And even Microsoft's losing out,
though. And even Microsoft hasn't been that successful, this is a similar thing that you have going on with all other kinds of market segments. I mean, on some level, having, at the very minimal level, barriers to entry are indeed low. Mom and Pop's books down the street can put up a website listing their inventory. But it's not really realistic for mom and pop's books to compete with Amazon, which is a company that spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on their back-end infrastructure, on improving all kinds of details of their site.
And the term for this, I think you use in the book, is winner-take-all economics, as it applies to the Internet. And what I said earlier, more or less, that it's an engine of monopoly as much as an engine of competition. And how does this apply to one of the core themes of your book, which is political information online and compared to the old world of old media?
Well, one of the surprising things you find on the web is that audiences for news and audiences for political content aren't actually less concentrated. There's no perfect comparison, but let's talk about newspapers, which are the form of old media that seems to have been most directly affected by the rise of the Internet. The top 10 newspapers in the country are only about 19-20% of print circulation, where the top 10 news outlets are now up to a little less than a third of all online news traffic. So what you're actually seeing with audiences is not just the long tail, not just audiences spreading out, but also audiences moving towards the very largest producers of news. And so that makes a big difference in terms of how we think about the online public sphere.
And this is reinforced, just if I make this clear for people out there who might be even less computer literate than I am, which is probably a small number, but I'm speaking on their behalf right now. This is reinforced going back to the Google discussion. So that if you enter something about a current event, Obama, Korea, G20, and you put that in Google and hit enter, probably the first three or four sites will be one of those 10 news sites covering it, or all of them. I mean, so you won't be getting any other sites. So you're going to logically click on one of them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And now we have seen, of course, the rise of blogs and outlets that were initially non-commercial as well. But you see the same kind of concentration with blogs.
Let me just, before you go into that, because this is one of the key chapters in your book, and I just want to set the stage for you a little bit, if I can, before you dive into that. Our guest today, who you've been listening to, is Matthew Hyman, author of the new book, The Myth of Digital Democracy, the award-winning book from Princeton University Press, on just how democratic the public sphere is online, how open it is, how inclusive, how much it is eliminating the problems traditionally associated with the old commercial news media or the old news media, including public media. And, you know, I think the ultimate chapter of the book is on the blogosphere, and it deals with this notion of amateurs coming along and using the internet to foist themselves into the public debate. And that's, I think, oftentimes held up as the ultimate contribution of the internet. No matter what else you might think of it, at least we've got the blogosphere. And having now set you up, tell us why I'm wrong.
Well, it's certainly true that there are the blogosphere has allowed some non-traditional voices to really really filter up into our political discourse. But there's a couple problems with the blogosphere from a democratic perspective, or at least a couple powerful trade-offs. One of the problems is that the top three dozen bloggers get more traffic than all the rest of the citizenry combined. Just like with online news, you have a lot of audience at the most popular bloggers, and a lot of the rest of the audience is spread out among people who are just getting a few dozen hits a week. So the result of this is a really hierarchical public sphere, online public sphere, where if you manage to get the attention of one of these popular bloggers, you can really have an impact. But if you don't, you're mostly writing for friends and family. Now, in some ways, this can be good because the people who actually do have succeeded in getting a large online audience are not exactly the sort of folks that that we often worry about. So Brian Williams, a few years ago, addressing a journalism school audience, said, and I'm paraphrasing here, said basically, after working for decades to get credentials to cover my field of work, I'm now competing with some guy named Vinny living in an efficiency apartment in the Bronx and hasn't left the efficiency apartment in years. In fact, that's exactly backwards. The people who have ended up doing well on the web are overwhelmingly people with degrees from elite universities, from elite public and especially Ivy League universities, people with graduate degrees. And in fact, contrary to a lot of expectations, the people who have ended up getting a lot of attention in the blogosphere and in related sites are actually more likely to be male and more likely to be white than you would see, for example, in the nation's op-ed pages.
No, in fact, on your book, you go through it in some detail on the backgrounds, and it's almost ironic that the sort of slum of the blogging superstars might be someone like a Glenn Greenwald who went to GW for his degree.
Yeah.
And, the rest of this crowd, it's strictly, it's blue blood. It's Harvard, Princeton, Stanford. It's really quite an extraordinary group of people that dominate the blogosphere.
And I think if I was rewriting the book today, I think that, the book really went to press before even the 2008 election. And I think one of the things that was starting to be clear then and is now even much clearer now is that there are a lot fewer blogs appearing and making their way into the top ranks than there were even just a few years ago.
There's a recognition that this shakeout's taken place and there are a handful of winners and there's no middle class at all that can aspire to becoming a winner.
Yeah, and I think you saw that really clearly in the 2007-2008 election cycle, because in the 2003-2004 election cycle, there were a lot of new blogs that rose to prominence. 2005-2006, there were a couple. But in the 2007-2008 cycle, there was really only one new blog that made it into the top 50 political sites. And it was a blog, of course, called 538.com.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a very different model than we'd seen before. It wasn't started off initially as a one-man band. It was sort of an offshoot of Daily Coast, this community progressive community blog, where Nate Silver had managed to find a following and build an audience and then spun off what he was doing in a separate site. And now, of course, 538.com has been bought lock, stock, and barrel by the New York Times. So you really do see the professionalization of blogging in very powerful ways.
Our guest, Matthew Heineman, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Matthew Heineman is the author of the book, The Myth of Digital Democracy, published by Princeton University Press in 2009. Has won numerous awards. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Champaign County on line one. You're on the air with Matthew Heineman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I heard a news feature about an enterprise, quote-unquote, of people creating pages on certain, like, I think it was mainly political candidates, but it was, the sole purpose was to proliferate pages so that the first page of the Google search would not include something that the candidate didn't want people to read about. This sounds like a dream to me. I swear I heard this as reported, and it just seems astonishing. But there are people writing pages about a candidate just so that, and then making sure it gets linked and proliferating it so that they know statistics are that most people don't look at the second Google search page. They just look through the first page and go on. And that they were just, it was a concerted effort to keep people from reading about something that the candidate didn't want them to know. It's astonishing in its implications of the way people are trying to, you know, sort of tailor the, and control news stories in this new age. I wanted you to comment on that and verify it, and if you can. And this is a bit of a digression to a more an economic issue, but I haven't found any other place to sort of rant about this.
You've come to the right place.
Okay. There are business, there are arbitragers and electronic traders and different sorts of derivative traders whose competitive advantage is they're closer to the digital switch and they have faster switches and faster computers. And they're basically doing these micro trades, and the only thing they're doing is getting the information a microseconds earlier than somebody else and just making their money off of this technological competitive advantage. It's to me, it's nightmarish. It's science fiction that can be regarded as a reasonable enterprise. But it's being done, and it's being done on a mass scale. Huge amounts of money are being accumulated in this way. And if there's not a reason for a transaction tax on business transaction, that wasn't, commented on or suggested in this Social Security Commission as a new way of raising revenues for government. You know, it's clear why it isn't, but I'll let that just hang in the air. But I find that it's just overwhelming. I don't know if you've looked into any of that. It's not really germane to your book, but you may have an insight on it from just watching this digital edifice that's being constructed going up. I appreciate time. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Matthew Heineman?
Well, the last part of that comment is in fact true, that there are folks out there who and firms, particularly big firms like Goldman Sachs, who invest a lot of money in putting their servers as close as possible to the stock exchange so they can have that few hundredths of a second advantage in trading, which is small in any one trade, but over time adds up to big effects. And this is a very different field, but it's very similar to what we see Google doing. It's very similar kinds of technology. Google called its project, internally, or at least some of their folks did, talked about it as their Manhattan project, their drive to really be able to run more processors more quickly, have more be able to throw more computers at a problem than any of their competitors. And that actually makes a difference. The caller's first comment, I think, is actually important as well, though. And I'm not familiar with too many clear-cut cases of this in politics. But it's now true in many other areas of business life, economic life, social life, that there are now online reputation management firms. And since it's hard oftentimes to remove something from the web, a lot of their strategies are to create other highly ranked documents that push whatever they're trying to obscure from view further down. And as the caller suggested, it's not going to stop somebody who's willing to spend hours and hours and hours trying to research on online. But as a practical matter, it usually works pretty well.
If you can drive something down to page 2 or 3,
yeah,
you basically made it. It's only going to be a small portion of the population that will get to the other website.
Well, and even, you know, these numbers are a little bit older, but even as of a few years ago, 2006, we have numbers suggesting that 90% of clicks on search engine results are on the first page. And I would imagine with new technologies, as the results have improved, if we've seen things like Google Instant, which actually shows you the top few results even before you're finished typing the query, that it would be actually even much higher than 90% of clicks are on the first page of results now.
Yeah, I would think so as well. And it does seem that there's no way Google can really account for that, right? I mean, this is something, if someone wants to spend enough money, sophisticated enough, they can fix the system to sort of have the top few entries be theirs, or at least push some bad ones down, ones they don't like.
Yeah, I mean, money really matters in getting the search results that you want.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only thing that matters, but if you have enough money to throw at this particular problem, you can generally be successful in raising your ranking or in lowering the ranking of something that you don't want to see online.
Our guest, Matthew Hyman, author of the award-winning new book, The Myth of Digital Democracy. We're talking about it live today in WILL AM 580. The number here, if you'd like to call in and join us, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now to line 4, Kankakee County. You're on the air with Matthew Hyman.
Yes, I was wondering if your guest would comment on the battle between Google and Facebook. I know Facebook just came out with they're about to come out with a Mail client, and I'm curious as to how that battle between the social network side of things and the search side of things might shake out, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Well, thank you very much, caller, and let me add to that or preface that if I can before you go answer it, Matthew Hyman, is that, you know, you wrote this book before Facebook was much of a factor.
Yeah.
First of all, maybe explain how Facebook alters the digital democracy argument you're making, if it does at all, and then take on the caller's question.
Well, Facebook, I think, is a very important development. It's really a new category of online behavior. People people are engaging with Facebook in a way that they really didn't with MySpace or with, you know, previous social networks like Friendster. I think that to the extent that there really is hope for sort of small scale direct democracy, it's through things like Facebook, where a lot of the interaction is not so much sort of quasi-broadcast interaction, as most blog readership is now. Mm-hmm. A lot of the interaction is more similar to what you used to see around kitchen tables or water coolers. Now, we know that in the aggregate, what goes on around kitchen tables and water coolers is really important in politics. At the same time, though, I'm a skeptic that Facebook had that big an effect, for example, in the last election. If you actually look at the pages of the of most of the candidates, with a few exceptions, but most of the candidates in the most competitive races, you really are seeing something on the order of a couple hundred Twitter followers, a couple thousand friends on Facebook. And that's, you know, and that's probably not going to swing. That's probably not going to swing the election in most of these competitive districts. But let me go back to the broader question about the fight between Google and Facebook. One of the things that you see online is that once a firm or a site gets established in a niche, it's very, very hard to dislodge. And so I think that what you're going to see is pretty much the status quo. Even as even though Gmail has been out for a long time, it's still dwarfed in terms of search volume by what used to be Hotmail and Yahoo Mail, Windows Live and Yahoo Mail still get far more traffic than Gmail does. And so, the extent that these things change, they change slowly. So I think that Google and Facebook are, I don't think either one is going to be very successful invading the other's turf.
It seems like there's plenty of turf for each of them to have right now, but
yeah.
Neither's going to go out of business if they have to stick with their current monopoly.
Yeah, that's correct.
Our guest again, Matthew Hyman. Matthew, part of the book that I found really interesting isn't just on media online and how concentration takes place there as much as it does offline or even more in certain cases. And so the range of ideas people are actually exposed to isn't that much greater, maybe even narrower. But it's also, you looked at the 2004 presidential races to see how the internet affected politics maybe in other ways in addition to news media coverage of races. And then specifically you looked at the Dean campaign. And what was so important about the Dean campaign and what do we learn from it?
Well, the Dean campaign is really the inflection point for digital politics. I spent a lot of time looking at websites in the 2002 campaign, and they were not a lot of congressional websites, congressional candidates. They were mostly terrible. But the thing about these earlier sites is that they were mostly focused on what you might term the median voter. They were really trying to reach independent swing voters, people who were on the fence and could go either way. Dean's site really wasn't like that. It was really about raising money. It was really aimed squarely at partisans and trying to mobilize and raise money from people who were already inclined to support Dean in the first place. And so the result of this is you really saw a transformation in what I call the back end of politics. The internet hasn't changed that much how campaigns spend money, but it certainly changed how they raise it. Well, you saw an awful lot of money raised by Dean raised online that simply wouldn't have been raised in the old campaign system. And you saw Kerry do the same thing, and of course Barack Obama do a similar kind of feats, but on a previously unimaginable scale. Barack Obama raised roughly $500 million. That's billion with a B on the web.
And a lot of that, I mean, what's striking, starting with Dean and through Obama, was that there was a whole crew of new donors or small donors, so that the small donorship portion of the total amount of contributions was much larger than it had traditionally been for American campaigns.
Yeah, that's right. And so, if in that particular sense, I think that there is pretty powerful evidence that in, at least in that sense, the web has democratized what has traditionally been the most elite form of political participation, that is, giving money to candidates.
Do you think, though, maybe you'll have to use the past tense for that sentence you just provided in view of the evidence of 2010?
Well, it's certainly the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which has sort of opened these floodgates of corporate money. I think changes the landscape of money in politics pretty dramatically. I think that to the extent that was a shift towards smaller donors being more of the total money spent, I think that most of those gains have been erased. Just in the previous election cycle.
And one of the other points you make, Matthew Hyman, in the book is at the time of your core research for the project, which was 2003 to 2005 or 6, say,
yeah,
that liberals, progressives, people on the political left, generally speaking, tended to be somewhat more active online than political conservatives. And you acknowledged when you made that comment in the book that there's no reason this will maintain like this, that this will, in all likelihood, change. Has that changed since you completed the book?
It's really been an open question. You see some hints of this changing this election cycle, though not quite as much as you would expect. You certainly see similar levels of usage among Twitter between liberals and conservatives. That seems to be pretty much at parity. Still, though, even with all of the Tea Party fervor and all of that, liberal or progressive leaning sites still get dramatically more traffic, almost 2-to-1 traffic numbers versus conservative sites on the web. And so that particular aspect of online politics really hasn't changed.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our guest, Matthew Hyman, author of the new book, The Myth of Digital Democracy, which has won numerous awards to much acclaim. Let's go now to line four, LaSalle County. You're on the air.
Hi, I just want you to know that your theme music is now being used on the Weather Channel for the local on the 8s once in a while. And I would like to just ask, you know, if you go look at old media versus Google, if you say go back to 20 years ago, or if you were reading the Chicago Tribune and you wanted more divergent views, you would have to go look for them, and you might go look, if you're on the right, at National Review, or on the left, you might go to The Nation or Mother Jones, and you'd have to search that out on your own, and you sort of respond. The responsibility is on the person who's looking to it. Some degree it has to be, and I just like your comments. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Matthew Hyman?
Well, I think the caller makes an important point, which is that for most communities in America, there's an explosion of information that simply wasn't available a couple decades ago. I mean, I can tell you, growing up in a small town in eastern Washington, if you were interested in politics, there were not very many other options. In fact, there were no other options other than the Walla Walla Union Bulletin. And so once you'd read the one page of international news and one page of national news, that was pretty much it. That was all you were getting. These days, even in Walla Walla, Washington, you've got USA Today, you've got the New York Times, and you've got thousands of potential news sites that you can read on the web. And in one way, of course, that's fantastic. In another way, it's also a big part of the reason why so many newspapers in recent years have struggled financially. Because we've spent a lot of time talking about monopoly. Well, local newspapers have long been a protected monopoly, protected by geography from competition. And that's breaking down with plenty of good consequences and some potentially very serious negative consequences as well.
One of the issues that occurred to me as I read your book and now as you were speaking, Matthew Hyman, was the as we've seen the decline in the number of people paid to do journalism in the past, well, it's been going on for a generation, but it's accelerated in the past few years. It's much lower on a per capita basis than it was 20, 25 years ago. So there's less material to be put online by paid journalists, by the conventional media that dominate the ratings you provide in the book of what people use for news media. Are we seeing any sort of tendency for public relations interests or self-interested commercial interests to sort of fill the void, to provide more access to information that suits their interests? I don't know if I'm phrasing this well, but an increase in spin and PR, either masquerading as news or just not even masquerading, just sort of being out there as information that people use.
To some extent, this is hard to measure. But one of the things that are relatively easy to measure is, it certainly seems to be the case that as the media environment is more fragmented, not in every way, but in some ways, PR spending has gone up. And certainly if you look at what's going on in journalism programs, there's lots of folks with journalism degrees that are going through school. They're not very many of them, or at least fewer than there were a few years ago, being hired by newspapers, which was previously where most of them went. Now, increasingly, you see a plurality of graduates of journalism schools going to PR firms. And that has pretty dramatic consequences, I think. For firms and organizations, there's still a need to get themselves out there to have their side of the story, their spin be heard. But it's a lot harder to do in the modern media environment. And that's part of, there's a lot of things that are paradoxical about the web. And one of the things that you see actually is that, in terms of, advertising campaigns, rather than being more efficient and being more mechanized, in fact, it's much more labor-intensive to do an online advertising campaign than it is to do an advertising campaign in broadcast media or in print. So as traditionally an advertising buy on broadcast network, they'd go to an advertising agency and they'd take a 15% cut and they'd buy the ads for you. Now, if you go to if you go to the same firm and say, "I want to do an online advertising blitz," 30% of that rather than 15% will go straight to the advertising firm.
That's really, is it because there's not the central buy button you can push, but there's a lot more labor involved?
Well, there's one or two. There's one or two central buy buttons.
That's true. Google.
But once you go and you buy the ads on Google, where do you go next? All right, maybe to Facebook. All right, well, that you run out of additional outlets very quickly. And that's one of the things that why people are very surprised when I tell them that, in fact, 85% of all online advertising goes to the top dozen firms. And so even as we've had this proliferation of content, the actual revenue from that content is actually really highly concentrated. And so for folks who are, you know, trying to do journalism, it's really hard to figure out how to make that business model work in the digital age.
That's an extraordinary statistic, absolutely astonishing. But not surprising, having read your book. Our guest today, Matthew Heineman, author of The Myth of Digital Democracy. We have time for one more caller if someone wants to call in here at WILL AM 580 at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Matthew Heineman, is the tee-off for your book. In your introduction, you cite a very famous law professor, Yochai Benkler, and I hope to have Benkler on the show. He wrote The Wealth of Networks, which came out a couple years earlier than your book, 3 years before your book. And I think it's sort of the definitive classical statement about the democratic bias of networks, sort of the Internet in particular, and specifically in areas of politics and public information. And accordingly, you take his argument is the starting off point for your revisionist approach. And I know Benkler, and I know Benkler blurbed your book and has read it. I'm curious, not just about Benkler personally, but of that large community of scholars that really had a great optimism about the web structure and the Internet architecture being, you know, a great promoter of egalitarian politics and democracy. How have they responded to your research?
Oh, I don't think they agree with all of it. I think they agree with it. I think they probably agree with more of it today than they did probably a few years ago. You know, I was just at a conference at Harvard last month, and you know, one of the big themes was real concern about. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that you know, you have firms like Google that are starting to behave in ways that. People didn't expect, or at least not everybody expected. I think there are concerns about you're starting to see more concerns about market power. And I think to be honest, I think in some ways my own research has. I think they've probably come a little bit more towards me, and I've probably shifted somewhat towards their view. I think that Benkler's work is not just a it's a very important work, and I think it's right about lots of things. But I think we need to balance the examples that we see. On the one hand, if you want to understand something like Wikipedia, Benkler's a great place to start, and that is something that he's absolutely right simply wouldn't have been possible a couple decades ago. At the same time, something like what you see now with Amazon.com, Amazon.com, Facebook, Google, eBay, these now nascent monopolies, are also part of what we need to bear in mind in understanding what the Internet is doing to the public sphere and to our politics.
Let's take one more caller for Matthew Heineman, our guest. Let's go to line one, Champagne. You're on the air.
Hi. I find that having the Internet has been much easier than shortwave radio to get news from all around the world. I personally I observe websites from Moscow, the Ukraine, Turkey, South America. I mean, just generally all over the place because I'm always looking for people, opinions that aren't mine. Also, the Washington Post and the Huffington Post side-by-side are kind of entertaining, CNN in particular. So I'm wondering, I have a feeling that not very many people use the web in the manner that I do. I think they go looking for people that agree with them. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's probably right. I think very very few people really have a really wide wide range of media consumption. You know, I talk about this stuff a lot, and usually my problem is that people automatically assume, unlike the caller, that the way that they use the web is exactly the way that everyone else uses the web. So one of the things that I come across when I'm presenting to academic audiences is I put up these charts of who's going where, and it seems like half the time somebody raises their hand and says, "Hey, wait, people still go to Yahoo?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not so much academics, but yes, millions of Americans every single day go to Yahoo. I think it's very easy to, I think even more so than television, it's easy for folks to assume that the way that they use the internet is the way that everybody else uses the internet, and that's generally not true.
You know, Matthew Hyman, we've only got about 3 minutes left, so I want to ask you first, if someone shares, reads your book and listens to you speak today and is concerned about that the internet is not offering maybe as many new voices or providing a credible platform for as many different voices as one had hoped from the internet a while back, or many still hope for, are there public policies that would maybe encourage less concentration? Is there anything we can do, or is this fait accompli in your view?
I'm skeptical. I think there are public policies. I think that unfortunately, I think it's pretty clear that net neutrality is one such policy that would help. But I think that that's probably I'm not optimistic that we'll see strong net neutrality policies. I think some of this I think part of what we need to do is to treat monopolies on the web much the same way that we treat monopolies in other places. I mean,
the way we used to treat monopolies.
Or the way we used to treat monopolies in other places. Yeah. I mean, this is not the first time that we have that information companies have tended towards monopoly. As you well know, Bob, we've seen this movie before. In many areas of American life and around the world, we've seen this kind of move towards concentration.
And then you get the classic point. Just to interrupt, because you're getting such an important point here. The classic point we had with telephone service at the beginning of the 20th century, 100 years ago, and in other technologies, where take something like Google. Is it realistic to try to break Google into 15 baby Googles? Is that fighting the sort of centrifugal force or the gravitational pull of network monopoly and natural monopoly? Or do you go the route that Andre Shiffrin recommends, the legendary book publisher, that you make it into a public utility and then have it all be run as a nonprofit, you know, concern? I mean, how do you apply antitrust to something like a Google?
Well, that is a good question. and I think that is often the case. I think the technology is probably ahead of the law, but I think that the principles are relatively similar. I think that regulation is probably, I think breaking up Google is probably not realistic politically. But I think that it's something that probably should be discussed. But I think that the most important thing is the willingness to be vigilant and to actually regulate abuses if we actually see that that's actually what's going on.
Matthew Hyman, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Matthew, thank you so much for taking time from your Sunday to join us.
Thanks so much, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Great. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board. Melissa Trentz, as always, for being my phenomenal engineer, and the backup band, even though they're moonlighting on me, I hear from a caller. Well, thank you all for joining us, everyone. We'll be back in 167 hours. Have a great week.